Today is Monday, April 4th, 2016, and we're here in Yerushalayim, beautiful weather. And as I said yesterday, anyone planning to visit Israel, the time is now. April, May, the weather generally is magnificent. June, July, it can get hot, but now it's perfect. Let's come right into Chabad. And as you know, last week I went to Haifa to visit my family there, Kanayim Hara. I have grandchildren and a great-grandson, and the Kanayim Hara, Kamina Fasha Tovat. So here we are in Haifa. We went back to the same hotel we had been in a year ago, because it's right near the medical school, and one of my grandsons, and actually my grandson and my granddaughter-in-law, both of them are graduates of the medical school and involved in research. And it was very convenient, and Malka liked it very much, very nice. And a boutique hotel, big room, clean, fine. The only thing lacking was that if you know the area near the port, if I can say it in Chinese, is nishta brekeli Yiddishkeit. There's no Yiddishkeit there. There's a dormitory of Haifa University. And you see, and there's a school for visual arts and other type of colleges. So you see one or two key part, but no Yiddishkeit. And it's so frustrating. We try to find, I have many other grandsons in the regular part of the Technion. So we looked around there and we had an address, and we find also a boutique hotel. No one answers, no one there, no guests. We couldn't even get in to see. So we was, you know, coming back Wednesday night from playing with our great-grandson on the beach, and but a little upset. And suddenly, as we approach the hotel, if you know Haifa, we tell my grandson to let us off from Rehov Hatzma'ut, so you don't have Oderech Hatzma'ut, you don't have to start going around to Rehov Hanamal, it's 10 blocks out of the way. We get off, and we're walking one little block to this boutique hotel, and we see beards and kippot, and we hear music, and God must be rewarding me for these lectures. 1/2 second, without exaggeration, from this hotel, that night, Beit Chabad was dedicated. 3 stories. We walked in, the Shluchah's father is there. We start talking, you know, he looks at me, you know, it's a Chabadnik, a guy gomor, no beard, no black, no this. He tells me his name. I say, I know your father. He came into the Mekarsky Tower in 69 and sold me insurance. The guy fainted on the spot. Kalman Shmulevitz is your father. Then Malka starts talking, who his son-in-law is, the Shaluach. Malka davened in his great uncle Shul, the famous rabbi of all time, the Rebbe's cousins. We were, again, Yiddish, geknipt und gebunden. Try to translate that, Charlie. Okay. Now, in addition, I have to say the issue I raised, I forget already, was raised in the Sunday class about women going to Mikveh Erev Rosh Hashanah or Erev Yom Kippur. So I've gotten 2 more letters from around the world that yes, more or less, it has been abolished. Women do not go, but each person recalls elderly women, Chabatnikiyot, going to mikveh, Erev Rosh Hashanah, Erev Yom Kippur. Also, a very interesting story from, and someone can take it after class, the Israeli Police Department. It seems Chabad has a rule that if you're out putting tefillin on anyone, it's not an excuse to be late for class. There's a time when you go out and stand on the street corner, and a time when you have to come to a shir. And here we're talking about Natseret Elite, where a Chabadnik was late to class because he's in the police station and everyone is waiting in line to put on tefillin, as a beautiful letter by the police to his Rebbe, to forgive the tzaddik for being late to class. And you have to read it, I tell you, overwhelming. So I've come back once again, if I'm not a Chabadnik, but at least I'm an admirer. Okay, now, we're dealing here with a very delicate issue, and you're going to see today how sad it is. And last week, of course, we went into the trial, and I just, the key story about the books and the trial, the heart of it is very simple. It wasn't just a fight about the books. It was a fight, who is the Rebbe? Who represents Chabad? And you see, in the election in 51, and I want to make this clear because some Chabadnik doesn't understand me to the end. In the election in 51, there's no question that Reb Menachem Mendel was elected over his brother-in-law, selected, I should say, by a tremendous plurality. But the family was opposed to him. That's the sad part. And the previous Rebbetzin, and we mentioned this months ago, refused to give her younger son-in-law her husband's shtreimel. And as you know, the Rebbe said, fine, we can do it without the shtreimel. And he never put on a shtreimel. And you can interpret it as you wish. I think part of his decision, I mentioned this and it's absolutely correct, he understood that in America you want to make people frum. Imagine in 1951 you're going to tie frumkeit together with a shtreimel. Today you have Americans who are seeking to wear a shtreimel. It's a different story. And even in Israel, when they introduced all types of laws here in the Knesset that you can't import furs, but they made an exception for shtreimels. You understand? But the Rebbe, but the family was opposed. They wanted Rav Shmaya Guraye. Now, I recognize, and I was told that some of the few people who supported Rav Shmaya Guraye, they mentioned he has a son. At least there's continuity. I recognize that the son was not already a Gon Olam, was not a Tzadik Yesod Olam. But you have to give at least credit that Barry Guraye went to Teira Vadas, he's a Teira Vadas Musmach. He then broadened and he was very close to his uncle. To a certain degree, his uncle was more of a role model for him than his own father, because he too became a scientist. But it was overwhelming that Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson Zeicher Tzadik Levracha was in a level that no one else could come near him in learning and knowledge and understanding and wisdom. The man's knowledge is beyond. I mean, there are a few people like that. I was privileged to know the Rav. Rabbi Professor Dr. Sam Dershowitz always tells me, you know what was amazing about the Rav? Shabbos afternoon in Maimonides, he sat around the table with the Balabatim, wasn't big crowds, and they shot questions at him. Among the people shooting questions was Mr. Rubin, Rabbi Yitzchak Rubin's father. And Sam Dershowitz told me one time he shot a question at the Rav, and the Rav says to him, Mr. Rubin, you asked me this question 3 years ago. He could tell him, and no matter what you asked the Rav, Kol HaTorah Kula, he responded. He knew everything. Knew the Rav, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. By the way, you should know that also I mentioned it when it came to the seminary. Professor Shaul Lieberman. Rabbi Lichtenstein once took his shiur to visit Professor Lieberman in the late 60s. And he said to the shiur, I heard this from the Talmidim. Rabbi Aaron said, you're going to meet someone that you can ask any question you want on Kol HaTorah Kula, and he will answer it as if he just learned it 1 minute ago. And they sat down with Professor Liebman and shot questions at him, and Kol HaTorah Kula Munach Lufanav Kukupsa. So, you understand, the Rebbe was the Rebbe, but this lingering feeling, imagine in the testimony, in the trial, in the depositions, and that's what we spent our time on last week, when they asked the Rebbe's sister-in-law, Chana Guraye, who's the Rebbe today? There is no Rebbe. Who was the last Rebbe? My mother. When my father died, the sixth Rebbe, so Rebbe Sandina Nakamba, that was her mother, and she was an Ishut, she was a public personality. She is the person we turn to with our questions. And remember what I said last week? It reminded you of Satmar. After the Satmar Rav died, Rav Yoilish, Many Hasidim refused to accept his nephew. He died. There were no children, no sons. No sons-in-law, I believe, at the time either. And they wouldn't accept the Sigitur Rebbe. Rav was a stockbroker. How can a stockbroker become a Satmarud in America? And these people turned to Rebbetzin Feiga. And I can tell you, I was in a Satma home in Chicago with someone who married in, Nebuch, they married into my Talmud's family, and I'll never forget the wedding. It's until today. I felt sorry for them. My Talmud insisted that I should be Kadesh, you know, Siddur Kedushin. And you're dealing with a family that is wealthy, and every Satma Meshulach and every Satma rabbi from miles around Chicago was at the wedding. And the word went out that a Reform rabbi, they couldn't believe it, a Reform rabbi was Messiah Kedushin. Who's this girl marrying? You don't know what happened. And it has a PS to it. Many, many months later, or I shouldn't say many months later, 4 or 5 months later, the wedding was in March in Chicago. I can give you the year, 1990. And that summer, I'm giving a drusha in Lido Beach. And sitting in front of me is a doctor, a son of a doctor, the grandson of a doctor. Know how many of you grew up in New York? Remember the name Shabbos Friedman? Do you remember the name? Dr. Friedman, this kid's grandfather, was the only Shomer Shabbos doctor in New York. And in Shabbos, he had a guy stay with him for all of Shabbos. In case he has to visit a patient, the guy would carry his bag, his stethoscope, and whatever he needed. And he was called Shabbos Friedman. His son became a doctor at Tzaddik. His grandson went back to his roots, a medical doctor, became a Baba V'chassid, because they came from Baba V'chassidim. So I'm giving this drasha in Lido Beach, and you know when I give a drasha, I'm throwing around sauces, and I'm getting carried away, and this medical doctor in Hasidic garb in front of me, Jason, he is crying. I can't understand it. Comes over to me after the shiur and says, "Ach, do I owe you an apology? You were Masada Kedushin in Chicago. I'm doing my residency in Chicago. And I thought you were a Reform rabbi." So you understand this, you talk about dress and what you look like. And here, look at the family, Bifnei Amvi Eda. They refuse to give the Shtreimel. They won't accept the Rebbe. They wouldn't accept the Sigitur Rav. And where did I begin? I came into a home in Chicago. On the wall was a picture of Rebbetzin Feiga. So I said to them, what does this mean? What's meant us? Here's the Satmaruv, here's Rebbetzin Feiga. Oh, since the Satmaruv died, we are followers of Rebbetzin Feiga. And this is what came out in public with Ne'am Vieda. And that's why the trial was much more than about books. It basically was about who owns Chabad, who is the boss, who is the Rebbe, and this is what the judge was faced with. Now, the Reb Chaim Lieberman, and let me pick off where we left off, Reb Chaim Lieberman becomes a very focal fixture at the trial, and he was part and parcel of the Gur Aryeh family. And I'm saying this not with any prejudice against him, because even those who supported Reb Menachem Mendel, they had tremendous derech eretz, Danny, for Reb Chaim Lieberman. And Reb Chaim Lieberman, when all is said and done, it's a great story, but a sad story. He never married. His whole life centered around the Gur Aryeh family. No one was a more trustworthy servant or savant to the sixth Rebbe than Reb Chaim Lieberman. He ran the library. He helped the Rebbe with his finances. He wrote checks, did whatever the Rebbe requested of him. And he, of course, lived with the Goodyear family in America. He lived in 7070, had his own little apartment there. And at the trial, he too testified that it's the personal property of the Rebbe, of the sixth Rebbe. But what came up at the trial, and this was very incriminating, is that he admitted he destroyed receipts and documents which would have shown that these volumes were purchased by Chabad money, and the Rebbe considered it part of the Chabad library, not his personal library. So this too was very effective in convincing the judge that it was a communal library, not a personal library. I want to mention, I get carried away when I start lecturing, I have a special Zchut Hayom. My nephew is here at the Shir, Harav David Hillel Rothkopf, my original name, and he follows in his uncle's footsteps, not his father. See, we get mixed up occasionally. I have grandchildren doctors. He has a father, a world-famous medical doctor, and he is a Rosh Yeshiva, but not just a Rosh Yeshiva. He was in a lot for many years. His Talmidim worship the ground he walks on. I've met many of them. Oh, you're his uncle, Matadot Shalom. And today he was asked to head up the B'nai Netzarim Yeshiva, which is built in memory of the Netzarim Yeshiva that was displaced from Gush Katif. It's way beneath Ashkelon. What's it, Brit Shalom, right next to, what's it called?
Hevel Shalom.
It's right next to the Egyptian-Israeli border, right near Rafiah. And they're building a major institution there today. And I have the schut, it's my nephew who is the Rosh Yeshiva. It doesn't hurt him to be my nephew, because I can tell you a story. When he was still in Eilat, he comes to Toronto with his Menachel Khalib, the yeshiva, and they're fundraising. And I gave him advice. I said, you don't raise funds, you give Sheyurim. The Mankal follows and does the pitch. That's the way you have to do it. So he's in, comes out with this, I think it was Dr. Lipson, if I'm not mistaken, a wonderful individual, the Lipson family, Kanai and Hara. And he says, oh, Rothkopf, wait a minute, I have books, Rakefet, Rothkopf, that's my uncle. So Dr. Lipson says, come into my car. Comes into the car and he turns on, what was it, a tape recorder at the time. It's before the what we have today, the diskettes. And the voice he hears is his uncle giving shir. So Baruch Hashem. Now, I'll tell you who else was brought in to testify at the trial. Elie Wiesel. I don't have to tell you the appearance of Elie Wiesel coming into court to testify at a trial. And he waived any compensation. When you testify at a trial, I believe there's a whole chart of money they're supposed to pay you. I also testified at a trial. I said, please don't embarrass me offering money to me. It seems, it's like you're paying someone to testify. It's not my cup of tea. But he waived payment. He said, none of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he gave beautiful testimony, which I don't know if it's entirely true. Even Rabbi Tlishkin has to make the point I've been making these last few lectures. He gave beautiful testimony that Hasidic Rabbeim are totally selfless. There's no concept of their having money. And he told some of the famous stories of the Hasidic Rabbeim, how they would go out at night after Chassidim came to them and gave them pidyonot, what they call a pidyon, with a kvittel, you give a donation. They took the money and went to the homes of poor people or sent the gabbai to distribute the money. Some Chassidic rabbeim would not go to sleep at night if there was money in their homes. They said, money is avodah zarah, you have to get rid of it. I can't have an Elul in my home. And Elie Wiesel testified, how can you think that all these thousands of Sfarim belong to the Rebbe personally? So Rabbi Plishkin has an addendum here, like he's quoting Rakefet word by word. This is certainly true in relation to Chabad. Remember what I told you. Their selflessness. The seventh Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, I mean, the fifth Rebbe, Rav Shalom Dov Bear. Who are we talking about? These people were selfless. But you have Rushin, you have Sadagara, you have Zahav, the Kesev, and all that goes with it, and wealth, and yes, there have been, in fact, certain Hasidic dynasties whose leaders and families had achieved significant wealth, deriving it from gifts from their followers. But this was never the case of Chabad, whose rebbes were known for leading lives of great simplicity. All right. When the court case was over, like, by the way, and this is very different than the way a Beit Din works, a Beit Din will always give a decision either immediately or within 24 hours. You don't allow that period to remain with the tension. You try to reach a conclusion as fast as possible. When Judge Sifton, I should say, the son-in-law at one time of the theologian, the pastor Niebuhr, the case was finished. He said, I now have a very difficult criminal case coming up in my court. It'll take me a number of months to write a decision. And it took more than a number of months. But in January of 1987, there was a turmoil in Chabad. The word went out that a decision has been reached. And the Rebbe was sitting and learning. I mean, there are descriptions of this. I thank Arya Liebman sent me more memoir material. There are descriptions of this. And the Rebbe suddenly looks up and says, was ist der Tumult? Was geht da? What is the noise here? What's happening? So they tell the Rebbe a decision has been reached. No, what is the decision? No one knows yet. So the Rebbe went back to learning. Within a few minutes, the word reached that the decision was absolutely 100% that the books belong to Chabad, and Barry Guraye has to return everything. What he took was illegal. It's not his personal property. What's very fascinating about the decision is that here this guy, this Gentile, but he evidently had a feeling for religion, having been son-in-law, he wrote a decision filled with Hebrew words. Not only that, he knew what hitva adut, yichudis with the Rebbe. He used the word Chabad, not Chabad, the way they would say it in English. He said it with the chaf. He may have known Hebrew. Wrote a beautiful, beautiful decision. And he quotes Chana Guraye herself, and it's a very fascinating quote where she says in the court, even my great-grandfather, the Marash, that's the Reb Shmuel, the fourth Rebbe, when they were burning the towns around Lubavitch, had horses ready 24 hours around the clock to save the Ketavim, to save the manuscripts. And the judge used that to show he recognizes how valuable these manuscripts, these books are, what it means to the Rebbeim of Chabad. Now, what did I tell you? Remember what I told you a few weeks ago? Isn't this an echo of what Dr. Tova Lichtenstein told me? When she was growing up, the Rebbe was not so sophisticated, didn't know what a vault is. One of the schools I visited right near where we stayed in Haifa was the School for Visual Arts, which I have a grandson involved in, and I wanted to see this. We had a very fascinating whole display there. Shabbos, my grandson was falling off his chair. They hear every word about the school, he and his friend, because they knew about it. So it's in a former bank, and the whole bottom floor where the display was in the classrooms, every room is a vault. You can't believe what those doors are like to walk into. So I know what a vault is about. And those vaults you could put in a library. I looked around what there is there. 100,000 books could be put into those vaults. That's how big they were. So remember what I told you with the Rav? He told his children, if there's ever a fire in the house, he showed them a box filled with manuscripts. All you take, don't care about anything else. You grab this box with manuscripts of Reb Chaim, and you run out with it. Later, it went into a vault. So you see, the judge understood. Now, it's very, very interesting that that letter, which I'm not so impressed with. Remember I told you the letter that the sixth Rebbe wrote to Professor Alexander Marx? Can you please intervene with the State Department? The judge considers that letter very important, and he was very angry at the lawyers for Barry Guraye, Chanu Guraye, for trying to say that the letter perhaps was not to be taken at face value. And remember, Chaim Schnitzer sent me a document, La Briut, from the early 40s, I think it was 43, 44, where the sixth Rebbe asked the State Department to enable him to report an etrog from Italy during the war, and they told him to go fly a kite. So I said, he realized the State Department doesn't know who he is. That's why he wrote to Professor Marx at the seminary, who was much more well-known. So a Chabotnik wrote to me, but the State Department did know. Didn't they save the Rebbe's life back in 26, 27, when he was sentenced to death? I have to tell you, Ma'inyan Shmita Leitzel HaSinai, the State Department couldn't care less about the Rebbe. But in 26, 27, congressmen, senators put pressure on them. They saved his life. They knew the senators, knew the congressmen. In 1940, they saved his life, got him out of Warsaw, brought him to America. It's not that they knew the Rebbe. It's the pressure. I was involved with, I know what I'm talking about. If you read Washington, you'll see I became an expert and how to contact senators, congressmen, put pressure on the State Department. I could have gotten to the president, vice president. It was an overkill, getting out the Essos family. I became an expert. They couldn't care less about the Essos family. But if you have a senator, contact them. They have to think twice. It's like my son-in-law, when he was going to see old Korea, he writes a letter to the Israeli ambassador. What do I do for Shabbat? What do I do for Kashrut? Where do I find the minyan? If with all due respects, Aaron Rakefik wrote the letter, they're going to the circular file. But my son-in-law writes the letter on his letterhead, and who he works for, he gets an answer. So it's not so much they knew the Rebbe. Also, you got to remember, the State Department changes. Every president puts in his own heads. And the State Department in the early 40s was notoriously anti-Semitic, as we know. God have mercy. So I still stand on my thesis. What Chaim Schnitzer sent me is important. And it could be that that letter, I wouldn't give it the same credence that the judge gave it. But that's my opinion. But the judge, one thing is for sure, that the Rebbe, the selflessness, this the judge understood. And he ruled with such passion in favor of the seventh Rebbe, and that it belongs to the Hasidut. Now, you have to remember, who was the lawyer? Our own graduate of Yeshiva University, the famous Nat Lewin. Nat Lewin and I were classmates in Rabbi Volk Shir, maybe Rabbi Bornstein Shir. We know each other for many, many generations. And Nat Lewin, fabulous individual. Remember what I told you, what the Rebbe said? I'll repeat it again, and it's in Talushkin's book, that the Hasidim, like that lady who wrote about Rakefet, why don't we get him to go to the Rebbe's grave, drink a l'chaim, mechveis, leave a kvittel there, put a Chabad-like hat on him, And the Hasidim got involved in that. They should turn that lua and adopt sign a chabadnik. And the Rebbe said, let the lawyer be a lawyer and don't turn him into a chabadnik. Now, Nat Lewin, I think of all the cases he handled, this was the most famous case. And what I'm holding in front of me is very interesting. They're celebrating 30 years since this decision. And Chabad had various celebrations, and Nat Lewin was the keynote speaker. Here he is, and that's Nat Lewin. And here you see all the Chabadnikim with the Chabad hat, but Nat Lewin is wearing a beautiful, very colorful kippah sruga. So, no, it's proper size. Nothing he knew enough to... And it's just amazing, how this put him center stage, and kol hakavod to Nat Lewin. Let me just go one step further, and I'll take questions. Now, here... I guess Rabbi Klushkin knew that Rakefet would be quoting from his book, so to make Aaron Rakefet happy, he says, I'm quoting, it's not me, my word of honor, but as a baseball adage attributed to Yogi Berra teaches, it ain't over till it's over. And of course, Barry Gurayeh and his family appealed the decision of the judge to a higher court. It took about another year, and the decision came back from the higher court even stronger in favor of the seventh Rebbe. The judge of the higher court wrote, what are you talking about? Rebbetzin Nechamedina never went to the library, never asked about its condition. Neither did Chana Gurayeh. Neither contributed to its maintenance. It was totally run by the Chabad organization. They paid a librarian full time to run it. There is no question, the appeals court said, that it belongs to the Chassidut and not to individuals. Yes, Yitzchak.
Did Nat Lewin do this pro bono?
I don't know. That you have to ask Nat Lewin. It's nothing said here. But I don't know. I would imagine you have to look at it from Nat Lewin's point of view. The time he devoted to this, he had to give up other practices. So maybe he took a nominal fee. Because he has a law office, he has expenses, he has people working under him, doing research under him. But I don't know. There's nothing said here. Maybe if Nat Lewin will one day write his memoirs, we'll have the answer to your question. Now, tremendous celebration broke out in Chabad when the decision became known. I'll give you sources and you'll see the celebration. They were singing, they were dancing. In one of the memoirs that come back from that period, I just want to show you, this is Chabad. So, how do you have a celebration? Those of you who've grown up in Chassidus, and I remember I was once told off, because I was at a Fabrengen Shabbos when I went in the mid-50s, and I didn't, everyone's drinking vodka, and they said, Numen daf drinking, you have to drink, and I told them, I'm not that type, but how will you get spiritual? I said, I'm Baruch Hashem, I'm a Litvak, I'm spiritual, in a Litvish fashion. So here, look, this was an ordinary weekday. No one knew for sure that the decision is going to be given. You understand? No one knew for sure. And then they heard of a full report, and the Rebbe acknowledged it was Baruch Hashem, a complete victory. The dancing on Eastern Parkway was in full force. Every few moments, another bunch of people arrived and joined the dancing. To everyone's surprise, there was no shortage of mashka, even quite early on. Where did they have the mashka? It seems two Bacharim said to themselves, what will happen if we win? We have to get mashka. So for a whole year, from after the court case ended and they were waiting for a decision, they collected mashka from Erni Simcha and started. You understand? You bring a bottle. You have in my shul, they don't save the mashka. In my shul, we never, ever drinking. Then when the old god died, little by little, there's occasionally a kiddush. When I have yard site for my mother, not my father, my father's Cholom Moed Sukkot, but my mother's yard site is normal time, Shvat, I give a L'chaim, it's not a, everyone calls it a Kiddush, it's not a Kiddush, it's a Hilula, the Neshama Zalhaban Aliyah, I become a Litvak, unlike Mori Taragin, I become a Chassid, unlike Mori Taragin, it remains a real Litvak. I'm a chassid at that time. It's hard for me to fast today. I'm a little older than Mori. Not by much, but a little. So, mintrinta l'chayim. But you can't leave it in the shul. So I have one box of, one bottle brandy. It was half full since 69. No one touched it. It took, how long has my mother gone? 4 years already. 4 years. Took 4 yartzeits to finish the bottle. A little half left. So these kids stored the bottles, and within a minute after the court case, about 10 minutes later after the news arrived, a station wagon pulled up with loads of mashka inside. So I have to say, as a Litvak looking on, I stand in awe of what Chabotnikim can accomplish. Yesh mei ayin. But here, it's very sad, the story. I remember Rabbi Parnas. By the way, this coming Sunday, you should come to class with the Rabbi Baban Spiegel's picture. I'm hitting it this coming Sunday. We're almost right there. Okay. Yesterday was a special lecture. I revealed sources that are not known about the Rav. Very moving, very moving. Could you imagine that I knew a man who saw the Rav as a teenager and pointed to him and what they said about him? Unbelievable. And he was a wonderful man, who I quoted Zuber, wonderful man, from no children, had no children, but had a beautiful, beautiful marriage with Raya. What's very sad, we were talking, this goes back to the 50s, I was very close, I always had older friends. Today I look for younger friends for obvious reasons. So it's very close with Dubi Hartman and wife and Teddy Parnas and Hannah, Louis Feldman and his wife. So a generation gone by. And Teddy Parnas, we were talking about the worst time of the year for families are the Chagim, particularly Pesach and Sukkot. Why? Because families get together. And whenever families get together, Rabbi, you know him as Rabbi Parnas, I know him as Teddy. And so Teddy said, there's always tension. All right? Sisters-in-law. You understand? Show me sisters-in-law that get along. All right? If sisters-in-law get along, that's a machin a shech, a yonoway, better yet, a baruch hatov ha-meter. And not everyone, you know your Rebbe, some of you know me well. Not everyone's like Rakefet. I told you, 61 Yitzchak, they knocked it out of me. You know me from before. I must have been a self-centered kid like every other kid. But wow, 61 knocked it out of me. There's always tension. It's very sad when a family fights in public. The split in the Schneerson family. And mind you, this is not an unknown family. As I said last week, and no one has challenged me. There's Lubavitcher Rebbe was certainly the most famous rabbi, spiritual leader of the Jewish people in the world. There's no question about that. And I mean, I'm a Talmud of Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, and I learned by Rabbi Aaron Cutler, and I spoke many shayas with Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, and they all know me, knew me. And I spoke yet in learning with Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. But we have to be honest. Rabbi Soloveitchik, you can't. Where does he come to the Lubavitcher Rebbe as far as influence over the entire world of Jews, no matter where they are? From Anchorage, Alaska, where Chabad built the mikveh, to Yerushalayim, Yerakodesh. And imagine, may arguably have been the most famous spiritual leader in the world, more than the Pope when it comes to spirituality. Could be. Arguably, I said. And imagine this fight going on in public that your mother-in-law says you are not the Rebbe. That your sister-in-law says you are not the Rebbe. Very sad. The seventh Rebbe attributed his wife's death shortly afterwards to the aggravation caused by this trial. You know that Chana Guraye was practically killed. And the Rebbe learned something from this that I think every spiritual leader should bear in mind. When the Rebbe spoke in public a number of times about the books and the anguish he has and broke down in tears. So one chassid, they say from Israel, don't get his name, he ran away, he was never put in trial, went to the Guraye residence and beat up the Rebbetzin Chana Guraye. She had to be hospitalized. And in the deposition of the rabbinate and the deposition of the Rebbetzin, and remember, bear this in mind, these two sisters survived the Holocaust. Their third sister was killed. All they had left were these two sisters. And they were very close. And look what happened. And as Rabbi Klishkin describes it, this came out in a sad moment during the Rebbetzin's deposition. The opposing counsel, Brian Kogan, after first establishing that the two sisters used to speak a minimum of twice daily, asked, quote, "Now you know that she, Chana Guraye, was injured in August of this year, don't you?" Rebbetzin Schneerson, "Oh yes." Question, "Did you call her in the hospital to see how she is?" Rebbetzin Schneerson, "No." Now you can imagine what this did to her. He writes, "The Rebbe believed that her life was shortened by the aggravation, by the fight over the books. More than that, the Rebbetzin died. The Rebbetzin died, and Chana Guraye did not attend her sister's funeral." That's what you asked me about, Yitz. And there's more to go. More to go. The saddest figure caught in a tremendous quagmire was Rav Shmayahu Guraye. Rav Shmayahu Guraye, and to his credit, remember, he assisted his father-in-law. It was a given in the 1920s into the 1930s that Rav Shmayahu Guraye would become the next Rebbe. He traveled with his father-in-law. Rav Shmayahu Guraye was lo amaretz. All right, he was not the Rebbe. How many people could be like the Rebbe? These were heads and shoulders. How many people can be like the Rav? But it was a given. And here the Hasidim, who were exposed to Reb Menachem Mendel as much as he wanted to hide, be an Echbala Kalim, and as much as he wanted to be an engineer in the Brooklyn Navy, where I think he worked till about 48, and as much as he envisioned himself as being a part of Chabad, doing what the sixth Rebbe asked him to do, but not being the Rebbe, Reb Shmayahu Guraye became a very devoutful chassid of the seventh Rebbe, his brother-in-law. Remember he said, I quoted it to you many months ago. Shmuel Gaya said, the difference between me and my brother-in-law is we can both go to the cemetery and talk to our father-in-law. But my brother-in-law will understand the answers he gets from my father-in-law. I am not on that level. And he recognized who the seventh Rebbe was. And could you imagine what this machloket did to him? It's the saddest part. Do you know that his wife left him? She went to live with Barry in Mount Clear, New Jersey. He remained at 770. When Reb Shmaya de Goraye died in 1989, the final line in the New York Times obituary read, quote, he is survived by his wife, Hannah, of Mount Clare, New Jersey. Now, Rav Shmuel Goraye is buried in the Chabad Cemetery, right near his father-in-law. Any of you who have visited the graves there of the 6th and 7th Rebbes, so the surrounding areas like a who's who, Rabbi Hudkoff and Rabbi Gordon and Rabbi Jacobson and Rabbi Goraye, one after another, those great Chabadnikim who were closest to the Rebbe. And Chana Goraye made provisions during this period to be buried at the Munkaches Cemetery in Deans, New Jersey. When she died, that's where she was buried. The Lashon Haranics, people who have enmity towards Chabad, within Chabad, you're always going to find people who rejoice in spreading false rumors. A rumor went out that the Chabadnikim gave the order that Chana Goraye could not be buried in the Chabad cemetery. Nothing was further than the truth. Within a few days, four prominent Chabadnikim sent by the Rebbe visited Barry, who was sitting shiver in his home, and pleaded with him, allow your mother to be reinterred where she belongs, at the Chabad Cemetery, next to her sister, next to her mother, your grandmother. Barry was polite, but he refused. The break was irrevocable in death as in life. It's a sad story. If anyone here has the ability to make an Israeli movie which will conquer Hollywood, this is the story, the trial, the books, Chabad. Yes, Mori.
Did they deposition or call Shmuel Goraye in the trial?
No, I don't think he was depositioned. It was Chana and the Rebbetzin who were depositioned. By the way, I was laughing last night. I don't know, my sleep, it hit me. I dedicated the shi yesterday in memory of Reb Meir Halevi Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rebbe. There's only one sibling left today, Reb Meshulam David. Reb Meir, who's a big Talmud Chacham. I think Reb Meshulam David is considered bigger from Yeshua, but he's also very big. There was another son who I knew who was more of a cab driver, also Reb Elder's son. And that's Brisk. If you don't learn, you know, he fought Nituchei Meitim, if you recall. That's the famous story of Avraham Soloveitchik came to visit Israel. I think it was his first visit here. And Reb Aaron came back. He said, oh, what they did to me Saturday night. What did they do Saturday? He went to visit his family. So this son of Reb Velvel showed him movies of bodies that Kefir Kadisha got to bury from Hadassah with all their insides cut open. You know, Nituchei Meitim, these were big battles fought in the, I think it's the 60s already. I remember this. They could do an autopsy at will. They didn't need family permission. You don't know what went on here. It was a Mapai communist country. And Rabbi Aaron, who was a very delicate soul, what they did to me Saturday night, they entertained them with movies of bodies being brought out. But so Yitz walked into class and he says, why did the Soloveitchiks do this? They all named their kids Yosef Dov, Chaim. Why he was mad at Meir, I don't know, but all right, he's making it. So I just want to tell you, do you know that a group of Chabatnikiyot graduating seminary here went, had a trip to 770 Eastern Parkway. On the plane, they were going out of their minds because there were 80 girls sitting there, each one with Chaya Mushka. No? Okay? And all the kids born 21 years ago, 22 years ago, Menachem Mendel's La Alafim, Halavai Lurvavot. So I don't know why you're mad at the Brisket dynasty. Say something about the Lubavitch Hasidim.
What about the books? How did they get back?
Oh, so what happened? Well, actually, I'll give you all the information, but to make a long story short, Chabad put the books back. They had to pay about 2.5 times what Barry received, $186,000. It cost Chabad over $400,000 to buy back. They ultimately bought back all the books. The Vatican was interested in the Haggadah, but once the court gave its decision, they backed off and they let Chabad buy it back from the bookseller who had it. In addition, there was a lawsuit and defamation, and they reached an out-of-court settlement with Barry, whatever, Chabad as the heir, the so-called heir to the sixth Rebbe. So they reached some settlement with him that quieted everything down. And I think Barry understood he lost and that any continuation just blackened the name of the family. So ultimately, once the appeals court gave its decision, everything quieted down. Now, what the Rebbe understood, and what's very important for a public leader to understand, and I had my face smacked, and rightfully so, back in 1962, when Ruby, remember Kiel Doswald for killing the president?
Jack Ruby,
right? It's a whole story. He was in jail, and Oswald, and he kills him, I mean, so, excuse me?
63.
63, okay, I'm a year, 63, yeah, you're right, the president was killed November 22nd, 60. I can tell you exactly where it was. I was in Valesburg at the gas station loading my first car, a second-hand Plymouth, with gas. It was 102, 103 when the first news came through. The president has been shot. He may have been critically injured. Little did I dream that one day I'd be in the warehouse, the book storage, where
the depository,
where it's a tourist attraction today, and I was scholar in residence there in Dallas, and they took me on a tour, and I could see where Oswald was standing, and they have marked off on, oh, you've seen it, on the highway where the president's car was. And even I was a sharpshooter in the army, and even though that was years ago, I think I could have killed a person from there. Shooting, it was very, very simple, very simple. Unbelievable. So I mentioned that Ruby was a Goel Hadam. So people told me, Rabbi, you got to be careful, because what you're telling is people should go and shoot indiscriminately. And believe me, from that 63 on, I don't think I ever said anything in public that people could go and kill. Privately, it's a different story. You let off a little steam. Rishayim Arurim, okay? Donnie, you tell Yomo I'm looking for him with a flashlight. Okay, Jason, you got it? Bring in, hit him over the head with an Allen hammer. Gentlemen, you got to be careful what you say. Now, the truth is that the Rebbe did his best not to speak about it. Three times he tried to arrange and had meetings with Rav Shmaya Goraye. He tried to see Barry. He tried to solve it quietly. he never succeeded. And finally, he went public. When he went public, he didn't mention any names. When the trial began, it was public knowledge. Obviously, everyone knew who he was talking about. He referred to it now many times, and everyone knew he didn't even have to mention names. After Rebbetzin Chana was attacked, he never spoke about it in public again. And here's where we always have to be careful. You don't know who's in the audience. Mental illness is mental illness. Rabbi Rubin and I, when the rabbinate, we dealt with cases of mental illness. I still shake when I think of some. I had one case, I visit this guy, teenager, and he's normal. We're talking about the President Kennedy. I remember a whole discussion, has to be 61, 62. And as I'm about to leave, he says, Rabbi, do me a favor, please talk with the head nurse. I believe the nurse is trying to kill me. And he's saying this to me in all seriousness. Subsequently, unfortunately in life, I've been involved with many instances of mental illness. Look what happened to Rabbi Adler, Morris Adler, in the pulpit. Remember, we spoke about it more than once over the decades. A kid gets up, but what I never knew and just came out now on the 50th yard site, that the kid yells to the congregation, what kind of rabbi is this? He's a Machalul Shabbos, he doesn't listen to the Shulchan Aruch, and he pulls the gun and kills the rabbi and then shoots himself as well. Kills himself on the spot. The rabbi, I think it was 30 days he languished. You don't know who's in the audience. Allah had come of a kama when you had a Fabrenian. And remember what I told you. Remember I told you I pushed my way up front, that 770, and this chassid with a long beard turns around and he cursed me out with salty language that only an MTA would have learned such words. And then I realized, you know, he's a chassid. He could be he was a merchant marine. I don't know what he did. Chabad picked him up and he turned him around. No, he's not a goyim, not a tzaddik. He's still that same vulgar merchant marine, but he's got a long beard and he's wearing a bekeshim with a gartel today. So you don't know who's in the audience. So it's also a very important point to learn from this. If you want to know how deep the division was in the family, do you know that when Barry got married, and he got married late, he refused to invite his uncle? And this is long before the books. This has to do, I mean, this breaks the heart. But I've seen it. I've seen it in families. Al-Basari Echazena, I know what I'm talking about. And his father, Reb Shmayohu, who made his peace, that he's not going to be Rebbe. And the seventh Rebbe is a gone and a tzaddik. His father pleaded with him to invite his uncle. And he refused. And nevertheless, his mother, Reb Tzimchaya Mushka, helped her sister prepare for the wedding. And the Rebbe had a number of talks at that time, extended Mazel Tov, and people asked him, there's a split, you know, with your nephew. Why is the Rebbe so generous? And the Rebbe answered, it is a simcha for my father-in-law. You see, that's that feeling that the Rebbe never, ever gave up thinking of himself as the shaluach of the sixth Rebbe. He never viewed himself in his own context that I'm the king, I'm the Rebbe. It's a simcha for my father-in-law. On page 576, note 10, here's the fascinating note that we've referred to. When Nat Lewin made the case in court, and by the way, Shmuel Shiloh testified for Barry against Nat Lewin on this. I told you, they brought in our friend Stanley Schimmel, Graduate of Yeshiva College 57, went from the graduation at Aliyah, later gets a PhD from Hebrew U, and he's not well today, he's older than I am, so he's obviously, when people ask me, are you teaching? I said, am I teaching? If I wouldn't be teaching, I wouldn't be alive. And by the way, my brother is still teaching, and my brother's not that much younger than I am. Right or wrong, your father is still teaching too, so Baruch Hashem. We should have our mother's genes, not your grandfather's genes. You got me? People say to me, oh, look at the genes. I say, idiot, I had a father too, not just a mother, you understand? So, Nat Lewin fought it out with Shmuel Shiloh. Shmuel Shiloh, Stanley Shimmel, claimed, and there is validity to it, that a Rebbe's money, caught gold, silver, belongs to him. Could you imagine what a silver cup of the Rishon LeRebbe would be worth today? Would you imagine? There's a bekesha they have of the Sadegur Rebbe from before World War II. It's kept in the family. You have any idea? There's a chair which the Baba Sally sat on. I think people pay a pigeon nefesh to sit in the chair and make a request from the Ribbono Shel Olam. And Yitzchak is laughing at me. Yitzchak, don't laugh. I have two Megillas. One Megillah is a big Megillah that the Rav used Purim night when he had to go back to Boston only at night, and we made a minyan in the classroom so he could catch the plane, and Moriah Rebbe and I stood next to each other or sat next to each other holding that Megillah. If you pay me enough, I might let you lift that Megillah. Got it? Okay. Yitzchak, Yitzchak. What can we do? We're also humans. We're also chassidim. When all is said and done, mizayin echid chassidim. But all right, litvisha chassidim is a bizalander. It's a little different. So you should know Nat Lewin got hell. This assertion prompted a criticism from other Hasidic courts in which it is generally assumed that all the property of the court belongs to the Rebbe and his family. Lewin soon found himself fielding angry calls from prominent members of Hasidic families. Quote, what are you doing? It's very harmful to us personally, because it's recognized that all property belongs to the Rebbe and the Rebbe's family. How are you going around and trying to take it away from us and give it to the community? Lewin, not wishing to provoke further anger, simply explained that different Hasidic communities had different views regarding the property the Rebbe receives from his followers. But the tradition in Chabad is that the property is the possession of the community. All right? Gentlemen, our Sunday and Monday class merge at this moment. Who have we been talking about for the last, 2 years already? Is it a year? I don't even know. Even when we did a Reuven Histad, Reb Menashe Klein, footnote 12. Remember I told you Reb Menashe Klein was an interesting personality, very broad and very narrow at the same time, with a wonderful sense of humor. It's the Ungvar, Rav Menashe Klein, Mishnah Halachot, 18 volumes. Brooklyn, today, Brooklyn, one son, Ramat, the other son. The Shtibel in Ramat, built by Eli Wiesel, in memory of his parents, with the money he got for the Nobel Prize. Thank God he didn't give it to Madoff, if you know what I'm saying. Footnote 12. Rabbi Menashe Klein, a legal scholar who was consulted on the case, was amazed that a Haggadah, it was a fortune paid for this Haggadah, was the most expensive item that Barry robbed. And he commented jokingly, what? $150,000 for a Haggadah? How could that be? Oh, I know why. Paro autographed it personally. It's Reb Menashe Klein. By the way, that's quoted in Moshe Bogomilsky's book. And by the way, I was wrong. It's not that it was published. a secret. It was self-published. In other words, it was not a publisher. It was self-published, but it's available. There's a Hebrew version, I understand, and an English translation. Now, another very interesting footnote about Chaim Lieberman. You see, Chaim Lieberman was very highly thought of in Chabad. This is an individual who cannot be dismissed. And many Hasidim were shocked when he sided with Barry and his mother against the seventh Rebbe. I mean, Chaim Lieberman was one of the Chabadnikim. Again, I can only say it in Yiddish, was a gesitzt eben that sat up front, bifneyam v'yayda, and suddenly he sided against the seventh Rebbe. So here too, footnote 13, very interesting. Many in Chabad were shocked when it came out that Liebman sided with Barry and his mother against the seventh Rebbe. But you have to realize, Lieberman, then in his 90s, had eaten daily at the Gur Aryeh's for decades. And this certainly made it harder for him to oppose this family, which treated him so well. And before I go further, I have to tell you in parentheses something that your generation, not the older people here, but the younger people, my father, Rabbi Rothkopf's grandfather, didn't know how to make himself a cup of coffee. My mother married twice, had a very nice second marriage as well to Rabbi Moshe Appelbach. Moshe Appelbach Morris, didn't know how to make himself a cup of coffee. What about your father, Yitzchak?
No,
he knew how. He knew how to. My generation already, because I saw my father and Morris, I'm self-sufficient. When my youngest daughter got married, I told my wife, that's it. You don't have to make me supper during the week. Shabbos, all right. To me, the freezer, to the microwave, I'm a king. But you got to understand, this is my grandsons are chefs. They bake, they cook. I'm amazed what goes on. They stand in the kitchen. The Rabbi Lichtenstein, I don't want to say who it was about, but we saw a couple came here for a sabbatical. Very wonderful people, very close to us and very close to the Lichtensteins. So Baron said about them, Friday, Erev Shabbos, Tzvei Yentelach Stein and Machin Shabbos. You understand? So yeah, my generation, what do I need? I need some. But you see, this is Reb Chaim Lieberman. I don't know if he knew how to make himself a cup of coffee. And you see, my father was an only son. His mother, your great-grandmother, doted over him. Ah, my Yingle. So you can, he ate, they gave him food every day. All right. Rebbetzin Gurayeh noted, this is Rebbetzin Chana, that she had known Rabbi Liebman for over 75 years, maybe longer. It also came out in Liebman's deposition that he had designated Barry Gurayeh as the beneficiary of his estate. So you see, there was something very, very close about them. I believe footnote 20 is the most important footnote. Hold on 1 second. I believe this is the most important footnote. And he's revealing information here which is personal, but in the course of history, oh, they found you. He sent out a search party. And listen to this. This is Rabbi Tlushkin. What is Rabbi Yosef Tlushkin's connection to Lubavitch? Remember what I told you a year ago? His father, it was the Rebbe's personal accountant. His grandfather was the great Posek Reb Nissen Tlushkin, who was a total, one of the most famous Chabad Hasidim. When you looked at the Rebbe sitting surrounded by the great people of the generation, Reb Nissen Tlushkin was there. His son was the Rebbe's accountant. So Yosef Tlushkin grew up in a home like this in addition to going to YU. As a teenager, I was once looking for something in one of my father's drawers, and I came across a tax return with the name Menachem Mendel Schneerson on it. if I recall correctly, the Rebbe received a salary of some $6,000 a year. A small sum, even in the early to mid 1960s, when this happened. Now, I want to tell you, in the mid 60s, I had a salary between my shul and being a Rosh Yeshiva at a very famous yeshiva known as Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. I had a salary of $8,000. I now have the right to boast that I made more money than the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Could you imagine? And believe me, $8,000 was not a lot of money. When I comment about this to my father, who acknowledged that the Rebbe drew a very low salary, and then rebuked me that I should not be looking at other people's tax returns. It was privileged information. Very interesting footnote. And this is Mesiach Lefi Tumo. You follow me? This is not a chassid who's trying to say something to make the Rebbe look attractive. This is a kid playing around in a drawer where he doesn't belong, and he remembers the Rebbe's salary. Yeah, so he's wrong. So it was $7,000. Do you understand what we're saying? I was offered, I spoke at a funeral, 1962 or 63, I don't remember, Mr. Abradim's funeral, the vice president of the shul. I write about him in Washington, about his last conversation with, it has to be 62. He spoke with Rabbi, it has to be 63, because he spoke with Rabbi Kutler in 62, right before Rabbi died. I write about it in Washington. So after the funeral and the rabbi, the you know, all his children, you know, the story of America were big shots in the conservative temple. And it was a conservative temple, the Reconstructionists. The rabbi himself drove to shul on Shabbos. After the funeral, the rabbi comes over to me and says, I will place you, La Brigada, I heard you speak. I will get you a job from the rabbinic assembly for $20,000 plus a year. Okay, we're talking 1960s. And I said to him, does it have a mechitza? And boy, what he answered me, I don't want to repeat in public. But, if you understand, the Rebbe is getting $6,000. What a footnote. Now, another footnote is very important. One of the other expert witnesses of Chabad was Rabbi Louis Jacobs. Now, Rabbi Louis Jacobs is a very controversial figure in truth today. That he was orthoprax, there is no question. When you read his writings, I personally have reached the conclusion he was very much in the trend of Solomon Schechter, historical school. You can't escape it. Gradual development of Torah Shabbat. And historical school, it means every generation added to the historic unfolding of the Torah Shabbat. What do you say, Yitzchak?
I agree 100%. Even that would go stronger because in his book on belief,
right,
he talks about that even believing in the divinity of the Torah is a questionable item.
Oh my gosh, even Torah Shabbat questionable. All right, if Rabbi Rubin's a bigger expert in these fields than I am. So that's why if he...
But he writes beautifully.
Oh, he writes beautifully, and he was a beautiful human being, they say. As a human being, they say, he was a mensch. And he was slated to become chief rabbi, and there was an outcry, and they did not allow him to become chief rabbi. And if you read his writings, I have to agree, as open-minded as I am, and as the Rav taught me not to condemn anyone, but I'm not condemning, but the man was conservative with a capital C.
His book, for example, on the Yud-Gimel Ikaros of the Rambam,
right,
was a masterpiece.
Right, no,
he goes through each one of the Yud-Gimel Ikaros, and he then goes through all of Chazal, at that time,
right,
later Chazal, and he analyzes it, and then he gives a scientific view of each one.
Right, right.
And it's superb.
No, he was much more knowledgeable than the chief rabbi who came in his place. There was no question. He was a Lamdan, and his knowledge was widespread. And they tell me he was a very nice human being. Now, he testified that, and very interesting what he said, there's no question that this library belonged to Chabad as an organization. And what was his proof? No one else said this. That in the library were volumes that were upi kursus, volumes that were anti-Semitic. They were communist books. And he said all this would indicate that the sixth Rebbe had these books and wanted it to be in a library available for research. How do you know who you're fighting with, who you're dealing with? How do you know what the enemy to Torah is thinking? And you see what was available in the library, and Jacob's said the communal purpose for the library is confirmed by the nature of the books that were collected. And his testimony, I need not tell you, made a very big impression on the judge. So you see, it's not just Eli Wiesel. They brought in heavyweight stars. Professor Jacobs, and you have to give him credit that he already was a controversial figure. This is the mid-80s. We're not talking now in the 1950s where he had not published many of his volumes and he was known by his speeches where there already were questionable concepts. But it shows you that he was an honest individual and raised an issue that no one else touched upon. The nature and contents of the library would seem to indicate by far that it was for public usage. I can tell you, even in Michala began, it's a very interesting history with Michala, because it began as a bridge between the Haredi and the Tzioni Dati world. It began in the late 60s, and this was a time when many ladies were afraid to go to public universities. There was no Yiddishkeit. It was rampant with drugs, with liquor, with sex. Everything that you read about, no different. Like the Christian world, so is our world. Michala came along, and you're now able to get a university education in a total Torah atmosphere. And that was Michala, the way it began. Later it has a foreign students program. As I mentioned in class today, Michala has a different agenda. It has to have, because it cannot get girls like it did in the 60s. Women today can go to any university. As I told you, I spent last week in Haifa. So I think I've mentioned I have two grandchildren studying in the engineering school of the Technion, for what it's very famous for. I have a grandson and a granddaughter-in-law studying in the medical school or doing research in the post-MD, etc., etc. My other granddaughter-in-law is studying for a master's at Bar Ilan University. She'll go on for a doctorate. She is one of the few people alive who knows both Rakefet and Professor Rothkopf. She studied with my brother, your father, in the optometry school. So my grandson and this granddaughter live on campus with their with my great-grandson. They live on campus. I'm describing it as it is. Housing available for this school of engineering. He's an aeronautical engineer, etc. No, we go to pick up my great-grandson from the Maon. Kids today are not raised at home. My wife is furious, but that's the reality. Go to pick him up from the Maon. Tens of kids running around with payas, with yarmulkes, with tzitzit. The mother's picking the kids up. Their hair covered down to their farm. Where am I? Am I in Kibbutz Chafetz Chaim or am I in the Technion? At least 80% of the people I see belong in Kibbutz Shalavim. I asked my grandson, how can this be? This is the Technion. He says to me, Sabu, don't you understand? Who gets married young today? Who has children when they're young today? From people. And this is the result. And this is the way the world runs today. No one is afraid to go to university. So Michala had to reinvent itself today to keep the campus busy, to keep students, to cover the expenses. So they have many postgraduate programs for master degrees, for men, for women. Who would ever dream that women, men, are going to enter the Michala campus? And you're not going to find, or you shouldn't find, upper courses in all these postgraduate programs. It's geared to be that bridge that a Haredi individual can come and study and advance and learn within the context of the Michala. Professor Jacobs was a fabulous individual, but he crossed the border, he crossed the line. You can't have a chief rabbi being a Solomon Schechter in theory, in thought. But you got to give him credit, he testified. Yeah, let me go, Fry. I want to go one step further. Yes.
One of the things that was in the, this is maybe, I'm not boasting, but I studied the doctorate at Drapsy. I studied with a man called Theodore Gaster.
What's his name?
Theodore Gaster.
Theodore Gaster at Drapsy. Was the Sephardic chief rabbi of England.
But in my life, he
denied that Hanukkah happened, that Purim happened,
everything. He said that Pesach was the fight between the forces of winter against the forces of summer. And then Hanukkah was the forces of winter against... It's all that was great. And yet, because of him, I grew. Because I was...
You were challenged.
Yes, challenged.
You were challenged. All right, this remains a problem. You know, the Rav's viewpoint was you have to go to graduate school. He told Rabbi Brandspiegel, if you recall, you got to get yourself a doctorate. The Rav thrived on being challenged, but not every individual can handle it. You remember David Hartman, the famous story with the plane that crashed. You fellas know the story, everyone else know the story. David Hartman had a good sense of humor. What can I tell you? We were so close 60 years ago, you have no idea. So David Hartman was the only one in my era who got smicha from the yeshiva and didn't have a bachelor's degree. Yeshiva had mercy on him because he came from Lakewood and he was married, he had to make a living. So they gave him smicha on condition he would finish the bachelor's, which I don't even think he finished at YU. He did it at Fordham University. I'm pretty sure I'm correct. When he finished the bachelor's at Fordham University, which is in the Bronx, near where his shul was, in that section of the Bronx, today you wouldn't have shuls there. It's good. The neighborhood's gone. And when he finished the bachelor's, they offered him a chance to study for his master's. With a scholarship, a bright guy, a rabbi for a Catholic university, that's a chop, it's a find. And he calls the Rav, Rebbe, I got my bachelor's, I have a chance to study for a master's, should I continue to study at Fordham? And the Rav says, what's the shaila, what's the question? You'll get a master's, good. And he says, Rebbe, I could become an apikoros, exposed to all their philosophies, theories. And the Rav says, Hartman, listen to me. Planes crash, but we still fly. Many years later, Hartman wanted to call the Rav and say, Rebbe, the plane just crashed. So, let me end off this. Two fabulous footnotes that I want to touch upon. Gentlemen, you all know the name of Shlomo Lekalbach. When I mentioned Hartman, I mentioned the Bronx. At the Brit of Rabbi Dr. Daniel Hartman, who heads up the whole institution today, I was at that Brit. It was in Hartman Shul, and I have an event memory. I'm sitting there. There's Duvi at the head, and right next to me here with the guitar is through his good friend from Lakewood, Shlomo LeKalbach. Okay. Shlomo LeKalbach had a twin, Elia Kalbach. Elia Chaim Kalbach. Elia Chaim rabbinated in Hillside, New Jersey, a stone's throw from Maplewood. We were very close. Elia Chaim's wife was very unique. I hope and pray that she's alive today as well. Hadassah Kalbach. Hadassah Kalbach was Hadassah Schneerson. She was a cousin of the Rebbe. Very brilliant woman. And Hadassah Kalbach was interviewed and she said, this fight over the books, between the sisters, over the secession, who should be Rebbe, it also affected all the children. And she told the following story. She tried to become close to Chana Guraye, cousin, her aunt, whatever the relationship was, cousin. And Chana Guraye told her, you belong to my sister, and refused to befriend her, rejected her. So you see, even a cousin, a wonderful cousin, a learned cousin, a pious cousin, Hadassah Kalbach, Hadassah Schneerson Kalbach, you belong to my sister. Finally, coming back to what we ended off with, they came to Barry Guraye and pleaded with him to reinter his mother. So Rabbi Moshe Bogomilsky interviewed the people who went to see him. And he quotes them. Barry spoke very cordially and very respectfully. In the course of our conversation, he referred numerous times to the Rebbe as their fetter, as the uncle, or as ihr Rebbe, your Rebbe. But he very carefully avoided saying the Rebbe. You see, in this conversation, here's Barry Guraye. You're talking towards the very end of the Rebbe's mission, the most famous spiritual leader in the world. And his nephew will not accept him as Rebbe. It's my uncle. Can't deny it. The fetter. It's your Rebbe. I can't deny it now. It's not my Rebbe. Very powerful. My dear students, we are far from finished. The show must go on. But let me review. Vasav Megatan Hait. My wife can't hear other speakers. She always comes back frustrated. Then I gained nothing. They don't review. I studied with the Rav. Every shiur would end. Was hat mir getan heint? What did we accomplish today? The next Tuesday when the Rav came back from Boston. Was hat mir getan letzte Woche? And half the time what he repeated was not all he did. It was his new mind working with innovations on the shiur of a week before. But what do? We finished that last week and this week's share. I hope it's recorded. And it's a good look at the trial. It's a sad story. It breaks the heart. It's a Hollywood movie. Look how the family is torn apart to the degree that even in death, they couldn't make peace. Look how Rav Shmaru Guraye has to face a terrible decision. Does he go with his wife or stay with his brother-in-law? It is so sad. Look how you'll always have a moron pop up on the screen. It's not a Shakespearean play with a jester, but this is a moron who beats the hell out of the Rebbetzin Chana Guraye. No matter how much you fight, you cannot lift a finger to another Jew. I'm a big right-winger, you all know that. But believe me, with the assassination of Rabin, you see how you must always educate. We have our opinions. There are other opinions out there. And chas v'chalila, we can't be like Yigal Amir and take the law into our own hands. Could you imagine if each Jew would kill the other Jew because he considers him an apikiris, an oisvath, a trumpenik, a pushtak? There'd be no Jews left. The Arabs, my father, Zichron Lebracha, used to say, your grandfather used to say, halavai, the Arabs wouldn't say anything, wouldn't fight us, just let us be. We'd kill each other and they could walk in and take over the country without firing a shot. And unfortunately, there is some truth to it. Now, I have to go a drop further next week. I have a little bit more I want to show you about the trial and about the Didan Nitzach. I hope I can finish it all next week. It is the last year before Pesach. And then we're coming to another topic about the Rebbe. Donnie, $99,000 linked to the shekel. Not for nothing will it go. Agreed to buy, added to the IOU list. What do you say? All right, Donnie Kaplan is willing. Gentlemen, the messianic issue from start to finish. Give me time. We will soon get there. I wouldn't miss next Sunday's class for all the shmura matzah being baked in Borough Park and Williamsburg and Muncie at this moment in time. We go one step further with Reb Heschel Schechter, the YU faculty, Reed's faculty, and the feminist mystique. And not just Reb Menashe Klein, the Rav. And we're heading in, someone just mentioned it to me earlier in our discussion, we're heading in to recreating the Rav and the feminist challenge, circa 1970s. Yes, Yomo, I haven't said a word. What does my good Russian friend have to say?
Oh, just that the Fabrinkin video that Rebbe developed last night.
Right.
It ends with, and the Rebbe will be back if you will redeem us.
Right, well, it's the Rebbe's alive during that video. He's alive. That video wasn't made.
No, it's recent.
No,
it's recent. It's made for a bar mitzvah, a recent bar mitzvah.
No, I understand, but it was recorded under the communists. They put it on. The Rebbe will be back and read it.
All right. And,
the Seder Messianist. Okay. I just want to remind everyone again, because if last week's tape didn't show, I'm the happiest man in the world that for years, decades, I kept on speaking about simple Sugihara, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, and how much we all here owe to him. I have to be honest, we, not just me. The fact that I was able to be the Makabeh Patish to get this building from Mr. Gruss, and the fact that I could give these lectures, it all goes back to the fact that I know Yiddish and could work for the Mossad and be successful in the little cities in Russia. It all goes back to Mr. Sugihara, who saved my Rebbeim, the entire Mir. What a story, what a story. Anyway, my dear friend Barry Liebman, who's the biggest stamp publisher in the world, who's not an official state, published these stamps for Granada and Liberia and Sierra Leone. Each one is a different country, and Gambia, I never even heard of these stamps, and these are all Sugihara stamps. So I have to say, what do they care in these countries about Sugihara? Everyone in the world who's a stamp collector collects about the Holocaust, collects about Japan, about Jews, anti-Semitism, Mir Yeshiva. These stamps are invaluable, and I've now shifted my stationery. I have to let my old stationery run out, and the new stationery is with a picture of Sempo Sugihara on it, and the quote from him, one second, one man can make a difference. Okay, but why you can't sue me, because it's underneath the Torah Umada symbol. If anyone is interested, this is a tshuva from Rabbi Lambs. I think it's his uncle. Eimek Halacha. Simon Membet, we quoted this in class a year ago, Mr. Mendelovich, I forget which class, Sunday or Monday class, but it's it was in the Monday class about the Malachim, it's going back a few years ago already. This is a fabulous tshuva. A person goes into World War II, his father makes a neder, if my son gets back healthy, I will give XX amount at Stucca. The kid comes back shalem, healthy, married to a shiksa he met in Italy. Does he have to give the tzedakah? It's yours for the asking. This is a fabulous article from the New York Times. As the Sabbath nears in Israel, Saka becomes a test of faith. These are articles on Chabad that I quoted in class with Nat Lewin. Please give this to Alex Glassman. He should appreciate it. This is very fascinating. The battle going on now between Welch and Kedem. I never even knew that Welch has a heksha. It not only has a heksha, kosher ledalit kosher. But when you've lived in Israel as long as I have, it's my 47th Pesach here, 48th. Whatever, I prefer Tirosh. Great, I can't, the Kedem doesn't speak to me anymore. It's amazing what happens to your taste buds. This is about Coca-Cola and how they led the way in allowing major companies to become kosher, Le Pesach, and how they let in Rabbi Tobias Geffen of Atlanta to see their ingredients. This is from Yehoshua Grinstein, my dear Rabbi Yehoshua. It's a fabulous article on a shiur given at YU by Rabbi Aaron Kahn. And our graduate of this kollel, my dear student, Rabbi Yitzi Blau, who's a brilliant individual, takes issue with Rabbi Kahn. You'll be very interested. This is the most beautiful article of all. If you read it without crying, you are not a human being. It's a miracle about a miracle that happened on Dan Bus number four in Tel Aviv in July 1951. This is an article that was sent to me from the Ukraine, Atlantic Magazine, Why Orthodox Judaism is Appealing to So Many Millennials. It's about a congregation in Houston and what's going on there. Some of it is from, some of it is semi-from, and I am so angry because a guy like me is painted as a modern Orthodox Jew. Never call me a modern Orthodox Jew. Call me a Torah Jew in Western or contemporary context.
Really, but you use the term Torah true Jew.
Torah true, but no, but I live, I'm not a Meisharim Jew, I'm not a Shtisel Jew. Live in Western context. Well, Torah true Jew, that's the word, beautiful, beautiful. Gentlemen, you won't believe it. The Borsellino Hat Company, here is a tour, Chabad evidently, Chabad, Menachem Education Center, a tour with pictures of how they make the hats that you spend a few hundred dollars on and why it is so expensive and how valuable the Torah world is to Borsellino hats. They have a representative dealing exclusively with people who need a black Borsellino hat. I was so moved by that. I said to my wife, if I be wealthy, I'd buy a Borsellino just to show I support. Gentlemen, you will not believe it, but Rabbi Steinman speaks like Aaron Rakefet. This is on Das Torah. I was blown away. We are exactly in the same boat. Baruch Shekivanti Lidat Gedolim. These are two issues of tradition up for keeps. If you're interested in reading, passing it on. One article is by Yaakov Blau, and one article is by Yitzchak Blau. They are fabulous. Yitzi Blau wrote on Das Torah Revisited, Contemporary Discourse about the Rabbinate. Yitzi, I don't know if you've heard my Sheyurim, but you ought to listen to my many months of Shurim on Das Torah. Fabulous article. And Yaakov Blau, our student as well, deals with Rishonim on Chumash with a unique concept of how to deal with Pasha.
Who is this Rabbi Steinman?
Rabbi Yehuda Leib Steinman, the Gadol Hadar of the Litvish world, B'nai Brak. He's 102 years old, and he speaks like that younger kid, Aaron Rakefet. Finally, I made copies of this. I highly recommend it by Rabbi. This is by Rabbi Rechnitz. One second, gentlemen. Rabbi Rechnitz. One second, Rabbi Rechnitz, the multi-billionaire who gave Lakewood hell. He writes about his father-in-law, Rabbi Belsky, when Shabbos arrives. This should be disseminated. Gives a Jew a feeling of what Shabbos is all about, and I so relate to what he wrote. My dear students, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for coming. Will everyone repeat after me? There are classes next Sunday and Monday. The Kollel vacation begins on Tuesday after Pesach. There are no classes Sunday and Monday. The Kollel picks up again on Tuesday. On Monday after Pesach, a guy named Rakefet will be at the Kotel for a bar mitzvah of a grandson of people I am very close to. I want to thank everyone for honoring me with their presence. I want to wish my nephew Baruch Vahatzlacha in building a fabulous yeshiva l'kavod l'tiferet hayadut hamamina u'ne'emana in such a wonderful area, showing that we are here to stay, Be'ezrat Hashem. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das V'danya.